Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
Support for On Point and the following message come from Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. Home plays a big role in your life. That's why Quicken Loans created Rocket Mortgage. It lets you apply simply and understand the entire mortgage process fully, so you can be confident that you're getting the right mortgage for you. To get started, go to rocketmortgage.com/onpoint.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Interior Secretary Ryan Zinke calls himself a Teddy Roosevelt kind of guy. It's true, the Montanan, outdoorsman, and former Navy SEAL likes to be out there in the wide open. He's been out this summer on horseback in a big Stetson, touring federal lands and the national parks. Back in Washington, conservationists in the Teddy Roosevelt tradition are aghast at the drill baby drill policies Zinke and his Trump team are pursuing. They say, the team says, it's high time. This hour on Point, the Interior Department's deregulatory push. You can join us on air or online, where this conversation is always on. Where do you stand on pulling back on restraints on oil and gas and coal extraction on federal lands, on methane emissions and offshore drilling? Have you seen Secretary Zinke and his horse out there this summer in the national parks? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Later this hour, we'll look at President Trump's sudden announcement banning transgender individuals from military service. But first, the Department of Interior, Zinke, President Trump. Here was the president at the Department of Interior in April signing an executive order to review, with an eye toward changing, maybe tearing up, 20 years worth of monument designations on federal lands that have protected a lot of territory across the country. He was praising his Interior Secretary, Ryan Zinke.
Secretary Ryan Zinke is doing an incredible job. And he never overlooks the details. He's a detailed person. Soon after he was confirmed, we had a snowstorm, big one. And he was out there on the steps of the Lincoln Memorial, shoveling the snow all by himself.
He shovels snow just like us. And he's out there on horseback. Here was Ryan Zinke in a department video produced earlier this month. He was visiting Oregon's Cascades Siskiyou National Monument. With mountains behind him, our public lands, he was saying, belong to Republicans, Democrats, independents alike, he said, and he went on.
Everyone cares deeply about the land going forward. Biodiversity, the protection of biodiversity, can and should be done in corporate and traditional use based on best science, based on good practices. And we have really, really good people in the Department of Interior.
Some interesting people that have come in with President Trump. Let's go there. Joining me now from Washington is Lisa Ryan, reporter for The Washington Post. Lisa, thank you very much for being with us.
Hi, Tom. Thanks so much.
First of all, give us a sense of Ryan Zinke's travels this summer, his touring of federal lands, national parks. We'd all like to be out there. Where's he been?
Well, he's been to a lot of national monuments, which, as you said in your intro, are under review. He went to Utah, for example, where probably the most controversial monument, Bear's Ears, created under the Obama administration, is up for discussion. He's been to about a dozen national parks, from the Virgin Islands to Manassas Battlefield, to Glacier, which is in his home area. And he's really been out there. Zinke has been an interesting kind of contradiction for progressives and environmentalists in that he came in, in his, confirmation hearing before Congress, saying that he really believed in public lands. That was sort of the most important thing for him. He has been, I think, a little bit more muted on his views of whether climate change is created by fossil fuels and is man-made. But then, and I think this gave environmentalists pause and thought, well, maybe he will continue some of the Obama-era policies. But actually, he has it's really been quite fascinating. He's been extremely active, more than many other cabinet secretaries, to in moving to promote American production of coal, oil, and gas. And that's, of course, a critical piece of the president's vision and the president's agenda.
President Trump has said all the way along on the campaign trail he wants to make America a dominant energy power and not shy at all. The national monuments, of course, that designation has protected a lot of land. You change or remove that, those protections go away. There's been a lot of talk about changes in personnel and assignments within the Department of Interior. This Thursday night massacre people talk about when a whole lot of people were reassigned. What was that about, Lisa?
That's right. So this was really a very a big move he made. The top executives in the government are part of what's called the Senior Executive Service. And there are maybe, I don't know, 400 or so of these I could be off, mm-hmm. In at the Interior Department. And he reassigned about 50 or more. And we understand that there could be further reassignments down the pike. And, just basically told them, look, if you want this reassignment, fine. If you don't, you know, the understanding was you either quit or retire. And among these, was a very prominent climate scientist named Joel Clement, who penned an op-ed for our paper for the Post, talking about what happened to him. And he was reassigned to basically an accounting role, and he has now chosen to use that as, you know, a platform to become a whistleblower. And the senior executives, you know, they can always be reassigned, and this is not a firing by definition, but it did seem clear in Zinke's case that he may have felt, and his staff felt, that people who were not kind of, who were resisting his agenda, you know, maybe needed to be another job.
I mean, this was a climate science expert, and he was reassigned to an accounting office that collects royalty checks from fossil fuel companies for their drilling on federal lands. It's almost twisting the knife there.
That's right. But it's interesting because in another, again, sort of contradictory move, you know, Zinke has been very clear that he feels that morale among Interior employees is very important to him. So, you know, he rode a horse on his first day into the office, and I think that was kind of a morale-boosting thing. And then very quickly, within the first maybe 2 weeks he was there, he enacted a policy to let employees bring their dogs into the headquarters, and they had a pilot day, I should say. In May, they're going to do another around Labor Day. And those are things that really are attempting to, you know, improve his relationship with employees.
Drill, baby, drill, and bring your dog to work. I don't know how all that balances out karmically. What about the story of Mark Zuckerberg and his visit to Glacier National Park? This was just, what, 10 or 12 days ago. The Facebook billionaire came, and there was a kerfuffle about how he was received and who received him and what they communicated to him about park, the glaciers, climate change.
This was a very interesting case, I think, of micromanaging by the Interior staff in Washington, and it was unusual for that reason. So wealthy people, celebrities visit national parks all the time. They're just like us. They want to see the beauty of the park. Zuckerberg is on this nationwide tour, you know, to visit states that he has not visited and, you know, sites that he hasn't visited.
Yep.
Zuckerberg is also very interested in climate change and has been critical of the Trump administration for withdrawing from the Paris Climate Accord, for example. And Glacier is a place, you know, that is kind of exhibit A for what's gone on with climate change, because many, many of its glaciers are melting, and you can literally see that. So it's clear that's why he went there. And his advance team, you know, asked, can we meet with the park superintendent? Can we meet with, you know, experts who are, you know, really conversant in what's happening with climate change? And so there's a resident guy who's a climate ecologist with the U.S. Geological Service who's actually based at Glacier. He studies the retreats of the glaciers, and he was supposed to meet with Zuckerberg and his team, as was the park superintendent, Jeff Mao. And just, you know, a couple of days before Zuckerberg's visit, 2 Saturdays ago, they were told, sorry, you're not going to be on the tour. And so the tour ended up being park rangers who are always very knowledgeable, not to denigrate them at all, but they're not the experts and on climate issues. And so both the superintendent and the climate researcher who I spoke with at length said, well, we don't know exactly what happened, but the superintendent was a little bit more pointed in telling me, well, I think this is kind of growing pains. You have a new staff in Washington and they need to learn that, you know, there's a balance between getting involved in what goes on at the parks and micromanaging. And he did say, by the way, that he is always available and frequently does tours and discusses the park and the issues affecting it, including climate issues for, you know, wealthy people as well as school groups.
But it looked like, don't be talking with a guy with as big a bullhorn as Mark Zuckerberg, Facebook, about climate change on our turf.
That's exactly what it looked like. And even though the Interior Department's press secretary was very clear not to mention climate issues or not to mention the real reasons why they may have gotten so involved in deliberating for days over who was going to meet with Mark Zuckerberg, she explanation was that this was a use of taxpayer resources that were not appropriate. That's certainly one way to look at it. The administration is very concerned with making government more efficient. On the other hand, Secretary Zinke has brought his friends and many other people to the top of the Washington Monument. I would assume that requires taxpayer resources as well. I'm not sure, but I would assume.
Maybe he offset that by when he was shoveling snow off the steps of the Lincoln Memorial. What about his self-characterization then as a Teddy Roosevelt kind of guy? Big conservationist, of course, Teddy Roosevelt. What do you make of that, Lisa?
That's right. Well, I think it remains to be seen. I mean, clearly, Zinke is from Montana. He lives in Whitefish. He is very, very tied to the West. And it's a great thing, you know, that Trump appointed someone who is from the West and knows a lot about, about the outdoors and public lands and appreciates public lands. That was all obviously a smart move. But we'll see, because it's also very clear that this review of the national monuments is unlikely to leave things as they are. And that would be a big change that would question where the secretary is on these issues.
We pretty well know where Donald Trump is, so none of this may be surprising, but it is something to watch as he heads out on horseback. Lisa Ryan covers all of this for The Washington Post. She's joined us from Washington. Lisa, thank you very much for getting us started today. Thanks for being
here. Thank you so much, Tom.
Support for On Point and the following message come from Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. Chances are you're confident when it comes to your work, your hobbies, and your life. Rocket Mortgage gives you that same level of confidence when it comes to buying a home or refinancing your existing home loan. Rocket Mortgage is simple, allowing you to fully understand all the details and be confident you're getting the right mortgage for you. To get started, go to rocketmortgage.com/onpoint. Equal housing lender, licensed in all 50 states. NMLSconsumerAccess.org, number 3030.
Hi, it's Tom. Before we get back to the show, I wanted to tell you to be sure and stay with us till the very end of this podcast for a preview of Freak Out and Carry On. It's WBUR's new podcast that addresses today's politics through a historical lens. Give it a listen, and thanks. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about Secretary of Interior Ryan Zinke riding the range at America's national parks this summer and what his department is doing with the rest of Interior's domain on oil, gas, coal, methane, drilling, land use, emissions. You can join us. Did you hear how Mark Zuckerberg was denied a briefing on climate change and shrinking glaciers in Montana? Have you been out to the national parks this summer? Have you seen Secretary Zinke out there on horseback? Are you following what Secretary Zinke's Department of Interior is doing back in Washington? Are you applauding, saying, go, go, for more drilling, more oil and gas and coal coming out of federal lands? Or are you appalled at the push to roll back restraints? Coral Davenport joins us right now, energy and environment correspondent for The New York Times. She's been writing on all this, and very compellingly. Coral, thank you for being with us today.
Hi, Tom. It's great to be with you.
So you remind us that Secretary Zinke has brought back the giant stuffed animal heads into his wood-paneled office there as Secretary of Interior. He's out riding the range. There's a new team coming in. And I wish you would introduce us to some of the political appointees who are most now influential in pushing policy in the Department of Interior. And let's start right up at the top with the Deputy Secretary, David Bernhard. Who is he, Coral?
David Bernhard is someone who knows how the Interior Department works, both inside and out. He was a senior official in the Interior Department in the George W. Bush administration, working under former Interior Secretary Gail Norton, who was a very controversial secretary with close ties to the oil and gas industry. She went on to be an oil lobbyist after she left. And that was sort of a time when the Interior Department was kind of aggressively promoting the oil and gas drilling agenda of President Bush and Vice President Cheney, of course, both former oil executives themselves. So David Bernhard held a number of top roles in the Interior Department in the Bush administration and then left during the Obama years. He was a lobbyist for a number of oil companies. Among his clients, his legal clients, was Halliburton, which was the oil and gas and fracking company formerly helmed by former Vice President Dick Cheney. And so in that capacity, he lobbied the Interior Department regularly for policies on loosening regulations, opening up public lands to drilling, lowering taxes for oil companies. And he was just confirmed as on Monday as the deputy administrator for the Interior Department. And, this was a very controversial nomination, very controversial confirmation. A lot of environmental groups, Democrats, government watchdog groups said there's a clear conflict of interest of putting someone who basically, until the election, until he came into this role, worked for the companies who he will now, who could benefit from the policies that he'll now have oversight over. When I talked to a lot of the oil companies and a lot of his former clients, they are delighted with the appointment of David Bernhard. Again, he's deputy administrator. He's the number two.
Yep.
We should not expect to see him having such a photo op role as the secretary himself. I think the expectation is that while the secretary is, the person that we see on the Twitter feed riding the horse through the beautiful national parks, Mr. Bernhard is going to be, back at the desk in Washington pushing through a lot of these oil and gas-friendly policies.
Well, look at those policies. There was definitely pushback before his ultimate confirmation in the Republican dominated Senate. But here was Senator Maria Cantwell of Washington, ranking Democrat on the Energy and Natural Resources Committee. This is just a week ago. She was on the floor opposing the nomination of the former oil lobbyist, David Bernhard, for the number two seat at the Department of Interior.
I'm afraid he's not draining the swamp. He's actually helping to fill it. The nominee's private sector experience as a registered lobbyist for companies whose main public policy focuses are in the Department of Interior, it creates an appearance of a conflict of interest, and the nominee wants to lead the department that he sued four times.
The appearance of a conflict of interest. Bernhard says no. What are the first policies that he has turned to? Where does the Department of Interior looking to reverse Obama-era policy, Coral?
A lot of the Obama-era policy on oil and gas drilling came as a result of the 2010 BP oil spill in the Gulf of Mexico, to this day often cited as the largest environmental disaster in U.S. history.
Mm-hmm.
That led to a big revisiting of safety regulations on offshore drilling, as well as the entire culture and structure of the Interior Department. A major investigation found that it had a culture in the years leading up to the spill that really prioritized pushing drilling over safety, lax safety regulations. And so there was a big investigation, a bunch of recommendations put forward. One of the big recommendations was that there was one office that had oversight of both collecting royalties and revenues from companies that were doing offshore drilling and really had an agenda of supporting and pushing and promoting that drilling because it brought in more revenues. Within the same office were the staff that did safety and oversight, environmental and safety oversight of regulations. So one of the big recommendations for this committee was to separate those offices because their finding was that basically the push for revenue from drilling sort of really overshadowed tough enforcement of safety regulations. Sometimes when you would have tough enforcement of safety, that would shut down or slow the drilling. So they were really in opposition to each other. So those two offices have been separated, and the idea has been that that would be sort of lead to a culture that prioritized safety overall. So the oil industry has pushed to actually re-merge those offices, and that's going to be one, including former clients of David Bernhardt's, and that's going to be one of the first jobs on his desk. And I should say that, you know, while that decision hasn't yet been made, Secretary Zinke himself has said, you know, he would like to kind of streamline things, eliminate red tape. You know, he's sort of come from this military background where he likes to see efficiency. And so he has spoken of that as something that could smooth things out and run things more efficiently. But David Bernhardt really has a lot of experience in how all this works. And so it looks like, you know, he'll be the one making that decision should these offices be re-merged. And I talked to Bill Riley, who was the Republican chairman of the BP Oil Safety of the BP Oil Commission, and he said, you know, this is the kind of thing that can put us back in the situation, you know, that led to the conditions of the Gulf spill. So he's very concerned about this.
Here's Elizabeth Warren. This was on Monday, protesting the Bernhardt nomination in the U.S. Senate.
With each day of this administration, this Republican-controlled Senate approves yet another corporate insider to help out big business. The decision to nominate Mr. Bernhardt is no exception. He is another conflict-ridden, climate-dismissing Trump appointee who favors profits over people.
Let's go to Garrett in Billings, Montana. We're talking about Secretary Ryan Zinke and what the Department of Interior is up to under President Trump. Garrett, thank you for calling from Montana. You're on the air.
Yeah, hi, Tom.
Hi.
I just wanted to say that when Zinke ran for his congressional seat, he ran under the message that he was going to protect, our national parks and protect the outdoors for everyone to enjoy. It's kind of like a staple message that all the Montana politicians run under. And it's clearly showing that that really wasn't his intention. And I think that a lot of Montanans are pretty embarrassed with what's going to happen now.
But isn't there, I mean, we've seen so much about how Westerners want to get out and tap the resources of these federal lands. That sentiment must be in Montana as well, Garrett.
Well, it kind of is, but it's a pretty conflicted thing. We kind of wish that it would happen everywhere else, you know. Oh, I wish we had more oil, but I really don't want it in my backyard. I don't want it ruining my favorite fishing spot. That's kind of the Montana mentality, and it's pretty flawed that way.
That's easy to picture. Coral Davenport, introduce us quickly to a couple more of the people that have been brought into the Department of Interior. Daniel Giorgiani. Who's he? What's he doing?
excuse me. So the Interior Department, like all the cabinet agencies, has been tasked by the White House with coming up with a panel to a deregulation panel, a panel to identify regulations to roll back. So one of the people leading that panel is this guy, Dan Giorgiani, who has also played a senior role in the Interior Department under the Bush administration, helping, kind of push a pretty pro-drilling agenda. He is also a longtime advisor to Charles Koch, who, of course, is the billionaire who is, one of the two Koch brothers who have been aggressive in pushing against regulation, promoting a heavy fossil fuel agenda, sort of playing aggressively in U.S. politics. So Mr. Giorgiani is someone else who is really bringing both a strong background in knowing how the department works, knowing legally what you need to do to roll back regulations or make changes, and also absolutely coming from, a strong corporate conservative donor world.
And then you've got Douglas Dominich, who's coming in to run the Insular Affairs Unit, most recently director of the Fueling Freedom Project at the Texas Public Policy Foundation, a group, as you report, that describes itself as out to explain the forgotten moral case for fossil fuels. In Ryan Zinke's Department of Interior, Cam in Davis, West Virginia. Cam, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Hi. Just calling. My wife and I are on our way to Katahdin Woods and Waters, one of the new national monuments in Maine right now. And,
beautiful, you know, beautiful.
We'll be supporting beautiful place, yeah, and we're excited about it. And, you know, if it was not a national monument, we would not be going. And along the way, we'll be supporting a lot of rural economies on the way with hotels and restaurants and kayaking rentals and all that stuff.
Yeah.
And I also live where we live in West Virginia. Our county is about 60% federal land, and, I mean, that drives our economy. And without that or with any damage to that, it would really harm a lot of jobs there.
And what about Katahdin in Maine? Is that related to Ryan Zinke's reign somehow?
Well, it was, in that it was one of the monuments that he was going to or that he was reviewing, but I guess he may actually be upgrading it, so that's good. But it's a good example of the benefits of federal land and protected federal land to benefit rural economies.
So there's a, sounds like a vote for protection right there. Cam, enjoy Katahdin when you get to it. Carl Davenport, please stand by in Washington. Randy Spivak joins us right now, Public Lands Program Director at the Center for Biological Diversity. They filed lawsuits against the Trump administration on coal leasing and Arctic drilling. Randy Spivak, thanks very much for being with us.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for having me on your show.
And Sean Regan joins us from Bozeman, Montana, Research Fellow, Director of Publications at the Property and Environmental Research Center, former backcountry ranger for the National Park Service. He profiled Secretary Zinke in May in the National Review. Sean Regan, thank you for being with us.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for having me.
Randy, you guys are bringing out the lawsuits. You're clearly not happy. What's got your attention?
Well, what's got our attention is the Trump administration and Zinke dutifully carrying out the wishes to make public lands dominant in terms of oil, gas, and coal use. And let me just say that I really appreciated Coral's article, because Zinke is a skilled showman, and he's out there, and I think it is really important for people who love our public lands not to be fooled by what they see on the TV cameras and the newsprint. Look behind the scenes. And so in terms of what the Center for Biological Diversity is doing, is we are suing on several revocations that have already happened. First, we are suing over Zinke's revoking of Obama's landmark moratorium on federal coal leasing program. This is a program that contributes 10% of U.S. emissions, exacerbating climate change. It has not been reviewed in 30 years. It is extremely outdated, giving away coal for pennies on the dollar. And Zinke revoked it in March, and we brought a lawsuit within an hour.
You're looking at Arctic drilling as well. What's going on there?
We are. One thing that Obama did was put a permanent ban on offshore oil and gas drilling in the Arctic and the Atlantic Oceans. And he did this because there was tremendous public outcry, and also knowledge of the incredible marine life and what kind of impacts that is to climate change. And so that was also revoked, and we again took Trump to court to stop the assault on our oceans and make sure Arctic waters and Atlantic are off limits to dirty, dangerous drilling.
And there that may go. Sean Regan, you're watching all this. Ryan Zinke has a reputation as an outdoorsman, a sportsman. I don't know. My brother-in-law is a big hunter. He's a big conservationist. Do you think the Secretary and the Trump administration are getting the balance right? They seem to be, as Coral Davenport reports, they brought in a lot of former oil lobbyists. They're really pushing back hard on some of these restraints. Does your outfit support that? Where do you stand? What do you see, Sean?
Well, I think, you know, the view from the West out here in Montana can be a little bit different from the view on the coast. I mean, the federal government has such a large presence in many of these western states. It's nearly half of the western states that are owned by the federal government. So
500 million acres, 20% of the country's land mass.
Exactly, one-fifth of the country is managed by the Department of Interior.
What do you take from
in
that?
Addition to, well, what I think what it means is that, you know, these questions of federal policy, of the actions the Interior Secretary takes, it takes on a lot of importance here in the West. I mean, it impacts not only the recreation and environmental issues that we're talking about here today, but also the lives of millions of Americans who depend on those lands for their livelihood. So
Obama tried to tighten it up. Trump is trying to open it up. Zinke is his guy on that. Do you think they've got the right way?
I think, you know, Zinke has said he wants to build trust, and these issues are salient here in the West, and they're controversial. We're talking about, you know, not just national parks, but lands managed by the Bureau of Land Management.
What do you mean by build trust? Build trust that the fossil fuel companies will feel confident they can get in there and drill?
No, what I mean is you've got communities, local communities, rural communities that are affected by these policies, and we're talking about issues such as, it's not just dealing with national parks and oil drilling. This is livestock grazing, timber harvesting, all sorts of matters like that are political issues, and they impact the lives of these rural communities. So these issues can be controversial in a lot of different ways, and that's where he's looking to build trust, is look for that more local involvement.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the Secretary of Interior, Ryan Zinke, Montanan, former congressman, former Navy SEAL, outdoorsman, sportsman, calls himself a guy in the mold of Teddy Roosevelt. He's been out there on horseback with his big Stetson this summer, touring national parks and federal lands back in Washington. A lot of former oil lobbyists have come in under President Trump, who has said he wants to throw these federal lands open to energy exploitation, wants to make the U.S. dominant in energy. And this is one big way he'd like to do that. Carol Davenport is with us from the New York Times, energy and environment correspondent there, been reporting very well on all this, what's been going on. Sean Regan is with us from Bozeman, Montana, and the Property Environmental Research Center. Randy Spivak from the Center for Biological Diversity. They've been filing suit against the Trump administration on coal leasing and Arctic drilling in federal lands. You can join us as well. Looking at land that has been designated as national monuments. This has been a way of protecting lands and resources. That's very much under review now, land that's been designated as antiquities. Isaac is calling from Boone, North Carolina. Isaac, thanks for calling. You're on.
Hi, Tom. Yeah, I just think that, important thing to look at here is when, Zinke talks about things like we need to, manage these lands correctly, things like that. When he says he's a conservationist in the mode of Teddy Roosevelt, I think we need to, interrogate what he means by managed correctly. When there's a large trend in, history of conservation in America of correctly managing the land being related to kind of destroying native sovereignty, kicking out people, genocide even. And like the recent designation of Bears Ears as a national monument came with it, with the idea that there's this like a coalition of native tribes, I think, who are going to like co-manage land. I think there's really an element of this impulse to say, of this kind of tradition in conservation, a very bad tradition in American conservation, that when he's talking about, we need to make sure Bears Ears is managed correctly, we need to do, things like that, I think there's this thought in there that, a very bad thought that these native tribes cannot manage the land correctly, right?
Isaac, we've got it. I want to go to that. Carol Davenport, do we really have to interrogate what Ryan Zinke means so carefully? I mean, his boss, Donald Trump, was extremely clear on the campaign trail. He wanted to throw off these Obama-era and more restraints on exploitation of energy resources on federal lands. Isn't that exactly what Ryan Zinke is and his crew are up to?
It is. And so, it was that's why the initial choice of Ryan Zinke was quite a surprise, actually. So, yes, I mean, Donald Trump campaigned aggressively on opening up public land, drilling and fracking, energy dominance. And so when he was going to tap the expected Secretary of Interior, the candidates were a lot of lawmakers and people with close ties to the oil and gas industry who sort of looked like they would really channel that. what ended up happening, then when he tapped Zinke, it was such a surprise. What ended up happening was that the president's son, Donald Trump Jr., an avid hunter, fisherman, sportsman.
Big game hunter. We've seen the pictures out of Africa with big, you know, I don't know, elephants, rhino, whatever he shoots there.
Yeah, so he's a big outdoorsman, games guy. He really liked Zinke because he was also this, you know, outdoorsman from Montana, hunter and fisher. He had almost no experience in this area. He was a one-term congressman. He had sat in his one-term, he had been a member of the House Natural Resources Committee, which does oversee these issues. Before that, he'd been a Navy SEAL, but, you know, just certainly had no background in the oil and gas industry. And it had a record, actually, in Congress of bucking Republicans, bucking party leadership on issues like selling off public lands. He voted against selling public lands, you know, and so in his very short public service record, you know, he actually did have a record of protecting public lands. And so a lot of these conservationists, sportsmen groups, you know, even environmental groups said, well, this is kind of different from what we heard on the campaign trail. Maybe we'll see something different. And so a lot of them, you know, these were like a lot of the meetings, the initial meetings that Zinke had were with these conservationists, with folks from the Teddy Roosevelt Conservation Group. And they said, you know, we felt good about this. We thought we might see something a little bit different. This was, you know, very early on in the administration when people were still kind of trying to get a measure of what, you know.
And now you quote them saying Zinke's been a disappointment, the head of the Teddy Roosevelt Conservation Partnership. I want to get a call right here, if I may. Donald Trump has said, let's go after this energy. We want to dominate. We need it. Rich in Johnson City, Texas. Rich, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I worked for the petrochemical companies for 20 years. I worked for Chevron, Shell, and Dow Chemical.
Yeah.
And this whole drill, baby, drill started back when we were not producing enough gas, oil in the United States. And that's totally changed now through fracking, which I'm not very happy with since I do drink my own well water straight out of the ground. Mm. We are now exporting fuel oils, processed oils at a very high rate, and we do not need to just drill into national lands. I think national lands make up America and its beauty. We have capped oil wells that are being uncapped as prices rise and prices fall. They cap them again. We have half the refining capability that we had in 2008, although the capacity for producing is much higher.
Rich, we've got it. You say no need to go in there. Sean Regan, what do you say?
Well, I think, you know, some perspective here is useful in that, you know, the Obama era, the Obama administration was very active in terms of developing oil and gas on not just sort of domestically, but also on public lands. And so, I mean, this was a point of contention by a lot of conservation groups with the administration, is that while it spoke the language of, you know, fighting climate change and promoting clean energy, there was a lot of development going on public lands. Of course, the rhetoric has changed now, and we're, you know, this is the Trump administration. They're very pro-energy development.
And they're throwing off Obama-era regulations. Whatever they did, the restraints are now under, they're in the gun sights.
Right, and I think it's worth keeping in mind, these rollbacks are for a relatively new regulations made during the final years of, in some cases, the final weeks of the Obama administration. So we're talking about, for instance, the coal moratorium, the moratorium on leasing new coal from federal lands. That was announced in the final year of the Obama administration. So it's not as though, you know, President Obama was not developing energy on federal lands. In
fact, we've got it. Randy, I've just got half a minute here. What do you expect before this administration is over? How much change, Randy? How much opening up of federal lands to energy drilling, et cetera?
We'll have to wait to see. I do want to point out that, one, the oil and gas industry already has access to 9 out of 10 acres of public lands, and they're sitting on a glut of wells that aren't even producing. So We know that Trump and Zinke have their sights set on our public lands. These are our natural legacy for our families, communities, and jobs, and we want Zinke to leave them alone.
Randy Spivak with the Center for Biological Diversity. We want to thank you for being with us today. Sean Regan from the Property and Environmental Research Center in Bozeman, Montana. Coral Davenport with the New York Times, always great on this, and very grateful to you for being with us today, Coral. Thank you to you all. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
In a moment, we will look at President Trump's announcement, kind of out of the blue yesterday, banning transgender people from military service via Twitter. This is On Point. President Donald Trump's surprise tweet yesterday banning transgender individuals from serving in the U.S. military is raising a lot of questions. He said he made the decision after consulting generals, but the Pentagon, including Defense Secretary Jim Mattis, who was on vacation, appeared to have been blindsided. With us now from Washington is Vera Bergengruen, a national correspondent covering the Pentagon for McClatchy. Vera, thank you very much for being with us.
Hi, Tom.
Let's just listen for a second to how Press Secretary Sarah Huckabee Sanders explained the rationale behind President Trump's decision to ban transgender individuals from the U.S. military.
The president's expressed concern since this Obama policy came into effect, but he's also voiced that this is a very expensive and disruptive policy, and based on consultation that he's had with his national security team, came to the conclusion that it erodes military readiness and unit cohesion, and made the decision based on that.
Vera, was this a military decision, as we heard it described there, or not? I mean, I'm seeing reports today saying the Joint Chiefs did not know the ban was coming.
Well, if it was a military decision, it was news to most of the military. The White House did tell us that Trump notified Mattis the day before he announced it, but it seems like nobody else at the Pentagon knew. When the news broke, everybody seemed completely blindsided. This just had never been under discussion. They had been discussing how to recruit transgender troops. There was a deadline on that for early next year. So there have been several other things under discussion, but people thought it was a settled matter that transgender troops were serving in the military. And the way that this was kind of put out as a blanket ban, the Pentagon did not know what was going on, and they referred all questions to the White House, who also didn't know.
You mean yesterday, when after it came out, when reporters asked, what does it mean, the Pentagon said what?
The Pentagon just referred all questions to the White House. It was clear that they had no guidance, that they had nothing to roll out, which obviously puts all of these troops caught in the middle who are transgender, who were encouraged to come out by the military last year, in a really bad position. And they just said that they're going to be working on this guidance closely with the White House, and then we'll let us know in the near future. But it's very unusual for the Pentagon to not have anything to roll out when something happens like this, a major policy change that affects troops, some of which are currently deployed.
So when the White House says this is about unit cohesion and military readiness, does that appear to be true?
Well, the Pentagon commissioned a report last year from the RAND Corporation to basically look at every data available to every single data point and figure out if that was true. And the report concluded that there would be almost no impact on military readiness, that would be very cheap, and that overall it really didn't make a difference. And that's why the Pentagon rolled out this policy last June under the Obama administration, allowing them to openly serve. And so as far as I know, I spoke to the report's writers, I spoke to defense officials, and that data hasn't changed. So, and like I said, the military, the service chiefs were caught by surprise as well. So it's not quite clear why this blanket ban, according to the president's tweet, it can only be interpreted to mean that people who are currently serving would be discharged, so which would be very unusual as well. So it seems that there's no data since the Pentagon made its last decision.
Does a tweet from the commander-in-chief constitute an order, Vera?
Well, nobody knows. As far as there's no, this is going to have to, this is all uncharted territory from what I can tell. Defense officials definitely thought it was very, they didn't know what to do with it because the White House also wasn't providing any guidance. There was no accompanying statement. There was no policy. And so they're not going to start kicking people out of the military based on this tweet, but now they're going to have to work, the Defense Department and the White House are going to have to work together and come up with some kind of policy. And like I said, this was never under discussion. The Pentagon was looking into how to recruit transgender service members, and lawmakers on Capitol Hill were looking at funding for medical care for transgender members, but nobody was really questioning the fact that thousands are already serving and that it was ever under discussion to kick them out.
We've got 1.3 million active duty members of the military. I mean, I've seen numbers everywhere from 1,500 to 11,000 to 15,000 active troops who may be transgender. Why this ban from the president, the commander-in-chief, so suddenly? What's the thinking behind where this came from? It seemed like it seemed out of the blue from outside, Vera.
It seemed like it was being pressured by several people, you know, the vice president, several conservative lawmakers. There was an amendment in, like I said, in the annual defense bill that was trying to block funds for medical care for people in the military who are transitioning. But nobody, what was shocking and what was sudden was that nobody was asking for him to actually ban all transgender service members in the military. And his tweet says, in any capacity. So there's really little ambiguity to what that means. And nobody, it's not clear. The White House has not answered questions. And like I said, the Pentagon is just referring us still to the White House. But it seems like he just went far, far beyond what either lawmakers or military officials were asking him to do, despite the fact that he said he consulted with his military generals.
Is this him trying to rally support for the rest of his agenda in Congress? You've got some very conservative members of Congress who might be applauding this, might have wanted it.
That could be, you know, and it obviously played very well in certain sectors. But like I said, you know, lawmakers themselves said they were not asking for this. You had John McCain, you had a lot of Republican lawmakers come out and criticize this because at the end of the day, it's people who are, many of whom are deployed in Afghanistan and other war zones, being told that they can't serve anymore. And, you know, they're able and fit. And also, if it's an economic argument, the president said that there's tremendous medical costs associated with this. You know, it's very, very expensive to discharge trained troops as well. And so it seems, you know, that even though it obviously plays well within certain sectors, very few people are supportive of this. And I think it's also noteworthy that no one, including Mattis, including any of his military generals, have come out in support of this as well.
I saw a number, I guess, out of that same RAND study saying that costs for dealing with transgender military members might rise between $2 and $8.5 million a year. That's 0.04% of the Pentagon, the massive Pentagon budget. It doesn't seem like so tremendous, but there's the decision. Is there a timetable now for how the Pentagon digests this and figures out what the White House means?
Well, that's what we're hoping. The other interesting thing is that, you know, Jim Mattis, the defense secretary, was on vacation. We, as reporters, were looking for answers. You know, the military is looking for answers. And so they're just going to have to sit down and decide how this actually works. I mean, do you discharge people? You know, when each service member fired under Don't Ask, Don't Tell, it cost $52,000 to discharge and replace each service member. So if it's a matter of, you know, those $8 million related to medical costs, and according to the RAND study, it would be only about 30 to 130 service members at most undergoing any kind of medical treatment per year.
Vera, we're out of time, but we've got it. We appreciate your reporting, Vera Bergengruen, with McClatchy, the president, commander-in-chief, giving orders by tweet now. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
Hi, I'm Ron Suskind.
And I'm Heather Cox Richardson.
We're the hosts of Freak Out and Carry On, a new politics and history podcast from WBUR.
Hey, thanks for sticking around for this preview from our show. If you like what you hear, you can subscribe to Freak Out and Carry On wherever you get your podcasts.
Take a listen to this excerpt. We chatted about Trump's approval ratings and historical parallels. And I guess my question is, when was the last time you had a president arrive into office and summon this sort of open, vigorous public protest?
Well, it was the presidency that everybody comes to first whenever they think about American history, and that was the presidency of Benjamin Harrison.
Oh, of course. I mean, the stage play, I love that, and the musical they did. It's fabulous, yeah.
Everyone always forgets about Benjamin Harrison, and there's a reason for that. He gets written out of history, but it was a very similar situation. A person who came to office after a Democratic president, Cleveland, who was popular among people who wanted reform, wanted to make sure the government did not work just for the very wealthy. Harrison said that he would make some reforms, including to the tariff, did not win the popular vote, lost the popular vote by 100,000 votes. Gets put in with the Electoral College. As soon as he gets in, it's very clear that there's been hanky-panky going on. People are infuriated by that. They start to protest, and Harrison and his men keep saying, no, 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 we've got this. We know how to make America work again, how to bring the economy back, although it wasn't actually that bad right then. He puts his son into an important position and simply refuses to note that there is these protests going on, that people are literally starving out in the West. And he completely misses what's happening out West, which is, again, this huge protest that becomes the Alliance Movement of 1890, which takes over the House of Representatives by a margin of 2-1 that year and virtually flips the Senate. And Harrison is completely blindsided by it.
Right, and drives politics forward from that point. I mean, in a way, the reaction to Harrison becomes the defining thing of that
period.
That's
exactly right, and that's where we get the populist movement. And again, the progressive movement grows out of that at the turn of the next century.